an interesting experience to talk to I'm usually don't give talks to sort of scientists outside of my field, and my field is neurothology, and just to explain, it's actually nicely links to Gail, and thanks for placing me in this section because it really fits nicely together. So neurothology emphasizes the study of neuroscience and the neural mechanisms of behavior in the variety of animals, using the richness of different species, approaching questions through comparative research and through different adaptations that different animals have in their different habitats and coming from different taxonomic groups. We do link very closely, of course, with people working with mice, but we do value the richness of working in the number of species and in particular insects. And the other a link that nicely Gail introduced as well is actually that my interest in my research is pretty much about understanding how animals see the world, sense the world, and what do they perceive. So sort of as a scientific approach to that. And I got interested in pollination when I was an undergraduate, and this is a quote from one of the key textbooks in this field, The Natural History of Pollination, and it has this quote that what actually interests insects in the surrounding world, the pollinating insects are flowers, so these are the main targets that they try to locate, and they locate them for feeding. But as the quote says, ecologists like to phrase it, they're usually attracted to the flowers in the first place by the flower's color and scent. And this is a very interesting partnership, a very interesting communication system, and it has been long emphasized that since actually the 18th century, when Sprengel wrote his book in 1792, that insects somehow are attracted to flowers by color. And that color must have evolved for the insects and not to please the human eye. And I was intrigued coming from a laboratory that was pretty much looking at the honeybee learning and memory to see actually that ecologists place a lot of emphasis on attract, but what is attracted? What are the psychological mechanisms of attractance, considering that pollinating insects are very good learners? So they don't have a kind of stereotypical response that urges them as soon as they see a flower or a scent to respond stereotypically, but they're incredibly flexible learners. So we use that learning ability to explore the sensory world of animals because we can ask them questions. And I come to this at the end of my talk again. But first, I want to say a little bit about the evolution of eyes and the diversity of eyes. So I'm mainly interested in color and the visual senses. And if you look through, so the next time you may eat scallop, just appreciate these animals have between 60 to 100 eyes, little eyes. And you see the immense diversity of eyes, even in things like nematodes. These are these little worms that live in the earth. You can only see them under the microscope. Or water flea have eyes. Spiders have eyes. We have two eyes, and the diversity also in the receptors per eye. So it's an incredibly interesting sense, but despite this diversity, and you would think that probably it takes a lot of time to evolve all these different eyes, and actually evolving eyes is quite simple, and this is some work from my colleagues in Sweden who modeled the progression of the evolution of the eye from something that is an eye spot and may trigger biochemical cascades and very simple things like dinoflagellates, so single-celled organisms, or simple cells like different corals that may have diffuse nerve nets, to an eye actually that can code spatial information that requires already with to do something with information, it requires a nervous system that can develop behavioral responses. And then evolving it through to the lens eye, as our eye is actually produces so much spatial information, so much visual information, that you need a brain and a quite developed nervous system to process it. So there's a clear link between the complexity of brains and nervous systems and the development of the sensory organs. And surprisingly, This can happen quite quickly. So the pessimistic estimate is that only a few hundred thousand years you can evolve an eye from an eye patch to an eye as we have. And interesting, despite the whole diversity, all eyes are very simply either compound eyes or lens eyes. So you can, again, trim this down into two basic systems, which apparently to many people seem as the big difference. So we all know insects have compound eyes, and we think they see the world very differently to us. That's not the case. So they see it differently, and I'll explain why. But it's not due to the optical structure. So essentially, a lens eye does the same thing as a compound eye. The only difference is you have individual lenses or shared lenses and the shape of the retina, which doesn't matter at all either, because in our visual perception, we don't perceive the world as concave, although our lenses are concave. And the eyes evolved when the modern animals evolved during the Cambrian radiation 540 million years ago. And the oldest fossils of eyes we find in trilobites, which were the compound eye. So the insect eye is evolutionarily much older than the lens eye. And about 25 million later, the first vertebrate fossils appear that have already a lens eye. So in our days, we find a clear dichotomy that most lens eye we find in vertebrates, but also in some in the cephalopods, and I'll explain why. And most arthropods have compound eyes. So the vertebrate line has gone into one direction, whereas arthropods have actually maintained not only the compound eye, but also lens eyes. Because as I said, optically, there's no difference between the two. And of course, let's see what the lay public thinks. So this is the wrong thing to think about the compound eye. Of course, it's not like this. It's the same as our eye. So I said there's no difference between the eyes, but what I omitted is there's a tiny difference. And this difference scales up with size. And that's where body size comes into play. So this very smart gentleman, Kudo Kirschfeld, a professor from Germany, modeled back in the 70s, he asked it, well, we know so much now about the optical structure of the eye, we can model a lot about the spatial resolution, so the ability to see detail. What if we would have compound eyes and they would have the same spatial resolution as with our lens eye? And he calculated our eyes would have to be 1 meter in diameter. So it means that the disadvantage of the optical design is that the compound eye, you need to scale it up proportional to the square of the desired resolution. And that's simply the reason why no big-sized animal has evolved ever big eye, compound eyes. So we find them mainly conserved in arthropods because they're small sized. And arthropods also have lens eyes. So this line, the invertebrate line, has conserved both them. And it's mainly in the vertebrates something happened that sort of fixed the lens eye and favored the lens eye, what we don't know. But importantly, you know that there are two factors. I talked about the size of brains and nervous systems. So the bigger the eye, the more evolved it is. You need more processing power to process it. But the other factor is, of course, the energetic cost. Big eyes are very expensive. So to carry around such a 1 meter eye will cost you a lot of energy. And so this explains why during evolution, when you actually, we talk about small animals, but actually the phenomenon of the evolution is that animals became bigger. So originally all animals are small, and as evolution progressed and we have this arms race between predators and prey, body size increased. And which brings then the increase of brains and the capacity to increase spatial resolution of the sensory organs. If you look at most animals, and I only have two graphs, so try to be, couldn't do without any, but sorry for that. So in Lütgow's Ecology of Vision, a fantastic book, he shows a very interesting relationship between body size, so he measured as body height, and the resolution. So here the bigger the number, the lower the spatial resolution. And he shows that bigger sized animals can afford to have eyes that have higher spatial resolution, so bigger eyes. And he also, Kuno Kirschfeld also drew what a fly could do with such a big, with our eyes, so it could grow its body size to be able to have this, to fit in this relationship. And we probably should ask, why don't we have insects that are that big? The answer is very simple, it's because of their way of breathing. So, so they got stuck a little bit in their evolutionary line. They can't grow very big. Interestingly, I point to these outliers here or to the ones that sort of at the edge, and don't ask me, I couldn't dig out, I wanted to dig out what these numbers mean, but I couldn't find my copy quickly enough. So interestingly, there are some interesting outliers. You may all know whales have very small eye, but very big body sizes. Some animals have very big eyes, so important, the sense is very important to them. And these two examples are actually prey species, so they need to be able to detect predators. And you will ask the giant squid, it is a prey species. So in the first place, preyed upon by different whales. And you have predator species, so like the swordfish has the biggest vertebrate eye. The giant eye is the biggest animal eye in the world. It's about football size big. And dragonflies have hugely oversized eyes. They're, of course, very good predators. Or these jumping spiders, very smart predators as well. Big, very excellent eyesight. Also some of the biggest lens eyes in the invertebrate line. This is the animal I work with. One of the animal species I work with, bumblebees, buff-tailed bumblebees. And as you can see, you have the compound eyes and three eyes. Does everybody see the little ocelli there? Three lens eyes. So lens eyes have been kept in the invertebrate line, and often people forget, actually, that insects have five eyes. And just to show the range of animals I work, so all this is smaller than a mouse, so so I have here the Western honeybee that all of you know, the bumblebees over there, and I recently started collaboration with Indian colleagues, and we work on the giant bee, not yet, which is sort of the size of hornet, but I work with the Eastern honeybees, roughly this size, and the stingless bees. And the size difference, so the Eastern honeybee is roughly the same size as Western our honeybee, and this is a small stingless bee. So one that doesn't sting, but it bites very, very badly, so with the mandibles, and it just sticks on it, and it attacks this one. So as soon as they discover our feeders, they will go into it, recruit more bees, and these bigger guys will stay away because they attack them very fiercely in their wings, and they will keep clipped until the bee dies, just of starvation. The little ones probably too. I never tested what happened to the little ones, but I've seen these very fierce combats between them. They're small size of the fruit flies that you get in your kitchens. And if you look at them under the magnifying glass, they're perfect, beautiful bees, and I could see them even with their pollen legs coming. Absolutely amazing. So, now bees have brains, so I need to show this, of course, and very small brains, but not simple brains. They're very, very complex, about a million neurons. We have a few more. And I'm not sure if that will work. I think that, no, it's not working, I'm sorry. So it's a nice animation where your brain turns around. So these yellow areas are actually parts of this brain that are devoted purely to process visual information. So visual information is very important to the bees. They devote a big part of their processing power to it. And so they're a very good species to study vision. So my research mainly has two strengths. What do bees see? How do they perceive the world? Is there a true sort of coevolution between plants and bee and pollinators, as the textbooks propose, back to Sprengel's ideas, and Darwin picked it up and framed it in his evolutionary theory. And so we try to elaborate different ways how we can ask the bees what they see. And my other strand of research is actually how do they find their way around in the environment, but I'm not going to talk today about that. So what we do is we actually use instrumental conditioning, or we train our bees, as you can do with dogs. And nicely here depicted by Herlof Bidstrup, surprisingly little known in the UK. And so essentially you pair a stimulus with a reward that the animal likes, and then it will do whatever you ask it to do. And you can do this with a diversity of animals, so people do it with horses and carrots and ants and sugar water. Bees also like sugar water. Crickets, of this little gecko there, and it works also in humans. So what one of the paradigms I use in my laboratory is to train bees to come to a wine maze. So you've seen in the other picture, we mark them individually, little spots, so we know who it is who. And they will learn to enter this apparatus, which is a box, and it has attached two arms. And we can now display at the end of the arm a artificial flower. And in this experiment, we asked it a very simple question, which surprisingly, by the end of the 20th century, nobody knew how far away you can place a flower and for the bee to be seen. So we just placed this, sometimes in the right, sometimes in the left arm, and the bees learn to come in, have a look, before they choose the right arm. So they learn, and then when they land there, they get their sugar water reward. And so then they go home, unload, come back, and next time the stimulus is in the left side, so they have to be flexible between the two arms and choose immediately the one where they see the reward. So the stimulus associated with the reward. So they do this very nicely, and then what we do is we increase the distance, or what we call the visual angle, so we can either increase the distance or change the size, and this is both characterized in the visual angle, and this is my second graph, and I'll just take you through very quickly. So we showed them each animal was trained to a particular color, and these colors were varied in their spectral properties, and what we find is that the first group of colors was detected down to 5 degrees. Now, this is obviously completely meaningless to you. In a sense, the only thing I want to say, so while the stimulus was very big and close, the bee could perfectly see and had nearly no errors. And then at some distance, it couldn't see anything and it was just guessing, so performance drops down to 50%. We had a second group of colors where the performance fell down to 50%. So at a shorter distance, the bee stopped seeing it. And what happened there is that simply we projected this by knowing the optical properties of the eye. We could project this stimulus and look how many omatidia it would cover. So how would it project on the retina of the eye? And we find that actually, yes, the stimulus, when it wasn't detected so far away, covered more omatidia, and the other less. And there's a very interesting correlation to our own perception, because the difference between the two classes of stimuli was that these colors had color and brightness, and these had color and brightness, and this one had only color. And in our vision, we do the same segregation. We segregate the image into color cues and brightness cues. So very, very similar similarities, and it is thought, because it's found also in other animals, it's a basic principle how our visual system operates. You extract at a low spatial frequency color and at a high spatial frequency brightness. And it observes different functions. So using brightness, you can be very fast, very accurate in finding spatial details in the picture. Using color, you identify items. So as you can see here, you wouldn't be able to say where the flowers are. You need colors actually to know that these pictures flowers. So object identification, this is the big advantage of having color vision. And surprising, or not surprising for me, but many people find this surprising, it has evolved in nearly all animals. So color vision in the 19th century is still thought to be a higher psychological function, exclusive to human perception, actually is found in even water fleas and other very simple animals, and small, of course, animals. Now, another interesting distinction that if I tell people I study bee vision, then of course everybody tells me, oh, bees see UV. Well, this is another big enigma that people always thought is something special, UV vision. Actually, it's very common. And even we see UV, as can be documented here by Claude Monet's work. He, because he liked to paint the pictures sort of repeatedly in several years, we have nice pictures before and after his cataract operation. So when the lens was removed, he actually could see UV. And this is because our photoreceptors do perceive UV. But it's filtered out by the lens. So UV vision is very widespread in the animal kingdom. And actually, honeybee color vision is much more similar to our vision than people think. It's just shifted towards the UV. And what people say, oh, bees don't see red. Well, they see it as black. So they still see red flowers. They are simply black to them. Now, the interesting thing is what we can do in a scientific approach to visualize. We can actually visualize in bee vision how things look to a bee. And I will show this in my last example. So as you see, the bee's color vision is mediated by three receptor types, and so is ours. So what we can do is we can measure with sophisticated cameras and spectrometers within the UV range and the visible range, and we can plot the color coordinates or the color system we just shifted from the UV back into our visual range, because we also are trichromatic. And as you can see, you probably can't see, so I tell you that actually we have a pretty crap color vision system, and maybe I tell you about this next time why, but actually our visual system is not ideally engineered, and this is because we are mammals. So thank you to mammals, we have a crap visual color vision system. Insects have a beautiful color vision system, and so have birds and other insects such as butterflies, because they space their receptors nicely equally across the spectrum, which is what an engineer would do. So you can optimize the resolution of your system, and this kind of overlap and sort of closeness here is not very good. So actually, birds and butterflies have the best color vision, because not only they space nicely the receptors out, but they also cover from the UV to the red. The whole range within biological vision is possible. If you have, so sometimes people argue, oh, there are animals with more receptors. Actually, you don't need more than four receptors. So this is the best you can achieve. After this, it becomes just luxurious and repetitive. So it's not really good. So what we do is we do measure flower colors, and this is a method where I use a multispectral method. So I go out in the field, I collect fresh flowers, and I image them with a UV-sensitive camera, and then I did what I just said, I shift them into our visual range, and suddenly this single colored flower becomes two colored. I'm not sure if you can see this very well. So you have a sort of violet surround, which means it's ultraviolet reflecting and also reflecting in the long wavelength region of the spectrum, whereas the inner part only reflects in the long wavelength region but has no UV reflection. And you see beautiful orange spots here, which are black for the bee because they are not very sensitive in the red part of the spectrum. Now, knowing the spectral, the optical properties which smart people have measured, we can then simulate how a flower looks to a bee from different distances. And so you can see, actually I can come here, this beautiful flower with these little nectar guides from 5 centimeters away, 10 centimeters and 20. You probably don't see much here. Okay, the bee doesn't see here either much. So as our behavioral experiments show, this is where the cutoff is, 5 degrees I mentioned earlier. Actually, this is invisible to the bee. And you see, actually, the bee is sort of, the flower becomes a quite ugly blob. And so thick. So the animal has to work with this kind of information, and it extracts information very well. But the main thing is that this low spatial resolution is due to the size of the eye rather than the optical structure. And it means that for small animals, the visual world is completely different mainly due to the size. And the way they will use visual information will be very different from how we use it. And I leave you here with a number of flowers. They are beautiful to bees in their way, very colorful, but I think they see the beauty somehow different from what we would in these flowers. Thank you very much.
Brilliant, thank you. Thank you very much. We'll take a few questions. Thanks. Reminding us of the sort of physicality of perception. That's what I like. I like that.